pristine beaches, delicious seafood, endless adventure. And of course, Anne of Green Gables. Those are things that come to mind if you ask anyone today what PEI or EPIGUET stands for. Indeed, a delightful tourism island that welcomes over 1 million global visitors each year on average. But how did our little island become a holiday island, Canada's food island, and soon to be one of the world's best tourist destinations, as ambitiously claimed by Tourism PEI? And what does the future hold for tourism in PEI? First, let today's episode bring you back in time to the early 1850s when it all started. Welcome back, dear listeners, to another exciting episode of The Hidden Island, the podcast that takes you on a journey through history, culture, and the incredible heritage of EPIGUET. I'm your host today, Camille Young Nguyen, and I'm the Communications and Fundraising Coordinator of the Museum and Heritage Foundation. And today, we are diving into a story that might just leave you stunned as we explore the history of tourism on the island. This episode is sponsored by the Confederation Center of the Arts. The Confederation Center of the Arts is a cultural center dedicated to the visual and performing arts located in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island. Make sure to check them out and visit their website, confederationcenter.com, to be in the know of their latest events and activities. Once again, we thank you for your generous support. The year is 1850, and the concept of paid vacations is virtually unheard of. Yet, on our little island, there are already people saying that this small colony could be a wonderful summertime escape for people who lived in bustling cities, or like Dr. Ed McDonald described.
Where the pace of life was rapid, where the pressures were intense.
Dr. McDonald is a history professor at the University of Prince Edward Island. If you're a longtime listener, you might recognize his voice from earlier episodes. Dr. McDonald is an expert on all things island, but that goes double for tourism. Along with his colleague Dr. Alan McGagern, Dr. McDonald is the co-author of the book The Summer Trade, A History of Tourism on Prince Edward Island. So naturally, we wanted to talk to Dr. McDonald about tourism's past.
We're talking about the history of the tourism industry on Prince Edward Island. While it's been a major industry in our past, our recent past, for a long time the tourism industry was really just, you know, summer trade, a minor sort of a supplement to people's incomes. But the roots of the tourism industry go back as far as 1850. And so an escape to the countryside and an escape to a small island with cool summer breezes and salt water would be a restorative for people, that they could mentally, physically regain a sense of their health and composure.
PEI didn't turn into a tourism island overnight, but even back then, a vision of escape, tranquility, and a slower rhythm of life was already brewing. As Lucy Maud Montgomery penned in her essay,
"You never know what peace is until you walk on the shores or in the fields or along the winding red roads of EPIGUET on a summer twilight when a dew is falling and the old, old stars are peeping out and the sea keeps its nightly tryst with the little land it loves. You find your soul then. You realize that youth is not a vanished thing, but something that dwells forever in the heart."
Who will say no to a heaven with true peace and natural beauty, right? But how did this vision transform into the thriving tourism industry we witness today?
A few people operated, you know, hotels, most of them small wooden affairs that were located in general on the north shore of Prince Edward Island. So even in the early part of the tourism industry, tourists were beginning to focus themselves on the north shore, on the Gulf shore of PEI. And so the industry developed slowly, and by the late 1800s, there was an emerging interest among some of the business people on Prince Edward Island that tourism had the potential to be something much more important. But it was really only in the 1920s that the tourism industry started to organize itself and started a deliberate program of marketing an image of Prince Edward Island. Already by that time, tourism had become a potential gold mine for people. And then for reasons that had to do with larger world trends, after the Second World War, tourism globally started to expand at a rapid rate. And Prince Edward Island's industry began a mushroom growth in the 50s and the 60s, a phenomenal growth, which is the typical arc of development, really, for tourism in new territories that are just growing. And by 1970, it was the number two industry in Prince Edward Island and threatened to overtake agriculture as the number one industry.
Well, guess what? Tourism actually has even beaten PEI potatoes in terms of dollar revenue to the province. The industry is growing in importance, and now it employs more islanders than any other industry. We know all too well that tourism in PEI looks like nowadays, but I'm sure our listeners are curious. What did tourism look like in those early days? How did those early travelers experience the island's charm?
Well, in the beginning, not many people could afford to be tourists. You have to have an inclination to travel. You have to have money and time. And most people in North America had little of any of those things. They might have had an inclination to travel, but most people didn't have a paid vacation. So if you were a tourist coming to Prince Edward Island in the 1800s, you're likely going to come by steamer or by train, and you would cross over to Prince Edward Island and you would take a conveyance to the North Shore and you would stay at a resort for weeks at a time in one place. And you would relax and you would imbibe the cool salt breezes and the warm surf bathing and the pastoral views of the countryside. And that has changed quite a bit over time, but that's essentially the nature of tourism. People consumed the pastoral landscape, and they consumed the culture that they thought had created that landscape. A people that were rooted in place, a traditional people who stood for traditional values and a slower, more authentic way of life.
Nearly 200 years later, seems like the essence of our island's tourism experience hasn't changed. People still come for a tranquil getaway in nature, but we've been welcoming a much more diverse range of visitors. We have invited Corinne Clements, CEO of the Tourism Industry Association of PEI, to share some insights.
Traditionally, if you look back quite a few years now, we were that family-friendly summer destination. So, July and August has always been what we would call our peak summer season, but a lot of families, you talk to a lot of individuals really from across Atlantic Canada, and they could say, I remember coming on that family trip. It was really a family, I think a family-focused destination for the summer months.
This is so true, and I can't even count the number of families with young children I bumped into on the street of downtown Charlottetown in the summer months. And it appears that throughout history, families of all sizes have been the major group of visitors to PEI. Dr. Edward MacDonald also confirmed that this has been a trend since the beginning of island tourism.
So in the beginning, if you're a tourist coming to Prince Edward Island, generally it was family. Generally they were middle or upper, middle class, white, European settler type people coming from urban parts of North America. After tourism began to spread through the population as a whole, the general idea of families coming to Prince Edward Island did not change, but now those families were coming by car. We got some young single people and we got some older, tourists, but we were a destination for families, particularly in the 60s and 70s when tourism was growing most rapidly.
If you're a parent of little ones, or if you travel with an extended family, can you just pack up and board the next flight to PEI any day? Probably not if your kids go to school. While the island has its doors open year-round, our tourism year has been limited to the summer, particularly July and August. And sometimes the shoulder season beginning late May, early June into December. And this has been a challenge since the last 30 to 40 years.
In more recent times, the last 30, 40 years, we've begun trying to appeal to people whose children don't go, have to go back to school in September, because that always put a kind of a limit on our tourism season. But really, the tourism season hasn't changed a great deal over the years. So there have been efforts made to try to push tourism across the seasons more fully. One of the ways we've tried to do that is to appealing to the DINKs, D-I-N-K, double income, no kids. So people who could afford to travel because they have no children in school in the spring or fall and have more income to spend and more time.
Quick question. What do you do on a vacation? Maybe you start a day with sightseeing and exploring the landscape. Then at the end of the day, you return to your cozy hotel room and curl up in that king bed with down pillows and 1,000 something thread count sheets. But is that it? Or do you also dine to your heart's desire three times a day? Someone said that the way to a person's heart is through their stomach, and there you go. Food has become PEI's strongest allure for off-season tourism.
What we've seen now is really an extension and an expansion of all of the amazing things that make Prince Edward Island unique. So, food, for example, culinary has really helped us to grow our fall season probably over the last, 15 years. That's been a big shift. So we've seen fall flavors happen, the PEI International Shellfish Festival, that's been over 20 years now. Some of these things to really celebrate the authentic island flavors. So that's helped grow us in the fall. I think when you start to talk about the spring and really actually, when you talk about a lot of our emerging product over the past few years has been very culinary focused, but also authentic experiences.
Objectively speaking, the culinary scenery in PEI is simply incredible. I can be biased, but where else in Canada will you find the freshest lobsters, mussels, oysters like on this little island? I'm drooling thinking of the delicious lobster dinner I had at the Water Prince Corner Shop, downtown Charlottetown. And thank you again, Shane and Cody of the Water Prince Corner Shop for the incredible meal. Even beyond the seafood season, culinary options throughout the year are endless. We have invited Crystal MacGregor, Director of Marketing and Communications at Food Island PEI, to share more about how food has become a way of life in PEI for locals and tourists alike.
So let's get started by talking about why PEI Canada's Food Island has such a unique culinary destination. We think it's because of its people, its place, and of course their world-class products. We're talking beef, beef terroir, potatoes, mussels, oysters, lobsters, world-class dairy. And not only that, but we're also home to the Culinary Institute of Canada, where they are producing top-notch chefs across this great country. And on Canada's Food Island, we know food, and I love that we can literally see where the food comes from as you drive by on this beautiful island. So we believe your food story starts here.
PEI food culture is deeply rooted in its agricultural heritage and coastal location. From the land to the sea, there's an abundance of delights that can satisfy the pickiest of taste buds. I know that sounds exaggerated. The island's potatoes literally have the royal seal of approval. And let's listen to Crystal's explanation.
PEI potatoes has a royalty connection. In 1964, the island presented a 50-pound bag of PEI potatoes to Queen Elizabeth II. The moment she tasted those potatoes, she reportedly enjoyed them so much that she had regularly got shipments of PEI potatoes to the Buckingham Palace, further cementing the province's reputation for our high-quality spuds loved by so many.
PEI has fertile red soil, which is iron-rich, making it a favorable climate to help produce potatoes. Back in the 19th century, Irish immigrants played a significant role in promoting potato cultivation, and potatoes quickly became a staple crop for island farms. It is said that their success led to PEI being nicknamed the Garden of the Gulf due to its lush potato fields, and that legacy carried on until today, when the island has been crowned Canada's Potato Capital by Statistics Canada. Data from the 2021 Census of Agriculture showed the island reported more than a fifth of Canada's total acres of potatoes grown at 85,235 acres. And how can we not mention PEI lobsters? In the early 1900s, locals viewed lobsters as poor man's food. So if you were eating lobster on a regular, you likely kept that to yourself for fear of embarrassment. Lobsters were used as fertilizers or cattle feed. And even worse, some of the Nova Scotia neighbors will tell you that prisoners rioted because they were fed way too much lobsters. And I'm starting to feel like I was born in the wrong time now that I happily pay $28.99 something for a lobster roll. However, European preferences back then varied significantly, as lobsters were considered a delicacy in Britain, and the introduction of canning technology in the 1890s allowed island entrepreneurs to seize the newly accessible market opportunity, and lobster turned into a valuable delicacy sought after by fishers. So islanders finally acquired a taste for lobsters, and by the late 19th and early 20th centuries, lobster suppers were then thoroughly enjoyed by islanders and visitors as a feast for celebration.
The tradition of lobster suppers is believed to have first originated as a way of locals in the community to come together and enjoy a bountiful seafood meal, particularly the lobster fishing season where the catch was plentiful. Lobster suppers were initially small-scale community gatherings held in church halls or community centers where locals cook and share freshly caught lobster with friends, family, and neighbors. Now, over time, the popularity of lobster suppers grew beyond the small community events and became a significant attraction for tourists all over the world visiting the island.
In addition to our agriculture and coastal heritage, cultural diversity also adds more to PEI's food scenery. Early settlers from Scotland, Ireland, and those of Acadian descent brought a lot of culinary traditions with them. Nowadays, we have welcomed new islanders with heritage roots from all parts of the world. You'll find ethnic restaurants with the best cuisines from Asia to Europe. And as generations pass these cultural influences, fused with local ingredients and practices, all of that contribute to the evolution of PEI's unique food culture. So far, we've learned about the evolution of tourism in PEI from a mere summer trade to a flourishing food island. Now, will that trajectory of upward growth ever change? Tourism is deeply intertwined with the forces of the world around it. The tourism industry can experience significant influence from external factors. Think of the worldwide economy, the ebb and flow of peace and war, the ever-shifting value of the dollar, and you don't say, gas prices. These are but a few of the levers that shape the tourism industry, and our beloved island is no exception. In the last recent years, the tourism industry in PEI has undergone a multitude of significant changes.
Well, I think 5 years ago, you know, we just had really three pandemic years. So 5 years ago doesn't feel like that long. Visitation was really strong. We were, you know, working our way to record seasons. 10, 15 years ago, I think that's when we really started to work on that season extension. We saw really strong culinary come into play. We started talking about programming and events and activities throughout the winter too. So we've really tried to streamline a lot of our activities and initiatives and the product development to align with that through the strategy.
Absolutely, there have been lots of innovation and progress in tourism, but aside the pandemic, there are still challenges that have been and may continue to prohibit the growth of PEI tourism. One of that is ease of access.
So we were talking about what factors affected the tourism industry. Well, there are lots of levers in the tourism industry over which we have very little control. But on Prince Edward Island, some of the factors affecting our tourism industry were finding a balance between being an island, and thus crossing to an island was something special, and being a place that was too far away or too hard to reach. By the 1940s and 50s, it was difficult to get across because there were so many tourists that the lineups at the ferry pier were incredibly long, and the facilities for looking after people waiting to cross on the ferry were largely absent. And so one of the factors affecting the tourism industry is ease of access. And we're located within a 12-hour drive of major urban areas in North America. So Boston, for example, Montreal, Toronto, New York are a little further away. But coming to Prince Edward Island means finding an easy and affordable way to get here.
Accessibility has become less of an issue after the Second World War, when automobile became widespread and more highways and sidewalks were constructed. That made it much easier for visitors to travel to the island by car. Maybe the problem would be permanently solved if the bridge was free. Just saying. Anyways, how's the weather like where you're tuning in from? I remember when we started recording and editing for the podcast, which was like last summer, I was constantly in my summer attire, sipping on several ice caps a day, but it still felt burning hot. Even now, this winter has been pretty mild. And while I'm no scientist, I can confidently say that climate change has affected our way of life to some extent. And we do have an episode in this podcast season where the Museum and Heritage Foundation director, Dr. Matthew McRae, and his brother, Daniel McRae, who's with McPhail Woods, discuss climate change and how it affected our island. So make sure to check that out. And indeed, with these currents of change, the climate definitely affects the island's tourism industry. Let's hear what Dr. McDonald had to say about this.
We live on a small island. We have no mountains. A lot of our province is not far above the level of the sea, and sea levels are rising. And climate change may also affect our patterns of weather. All of that has implications for the tourism industry, especially since so much of the accommodation industry is situated along the coastline, and our coastlines are vulnerable. The sandstone base of Prince Edward Island is soft and easily eroded, and major storms take a toll on the coastline. Increasingly in recent years, the storms have been increasing in intensity and frequency. People have been losing their cottages, people have been losing their homes, people have been losing their beaches. So that's a real concern, especially for a tourism industry that tends to cling to the coastline for its major attraction. It's too early now to know what other results may stem from climate change.
Dr. Ed McDonald left us with many, many questions. Will the summers get hotter? Will they get wetter? Will Prince Edward Island continue to be a refuge with cooling sea breezes where the heat of the day cools off nicely in the evening? Or will we become more susceptible to hurricanes? What will happen to our next spring, summers, falls, and winters? No one has a definite answer to those questions yet, but natural disasters are something that we can expect and will need a plan around. If you want to learn more about the history and projection of natural disasters and climate change in PEI, remember again, check out our episode in the season of The Hidden Island hosted by brother Daniel McRae and Matthew McRae. Let's also talk about the positive changes that took place. A while ago, we've learned that as the island grew in accessibility, tourists came more frequently and were staying for a shorter duration. A shift from months-long stays to shorter vacations by car created new waves of experiences. Families seeking the solace of landscapes embraced a journey, and the island responded in kind, adapting its offerings to the need of its visitors. And so the kinds of accommodation available in PEI also evolved for the better.
The seaside kind of resort eventually gave way to the tourist cabin and then to the motel, catering to people who travel by car. The word is a short form of motor hotel, the motel. And in recent years, of course, there's Airbnbs, people in the Second World War, post-war era, I should say, increasingly decided to camp because camping costs less than trying to rent a room. People with families were looking for affordable accommodation. So Prince Edward Island's had to cater to that in terms of its infrastructure. It's become much more accessible. And of course, by the 50s and the 60s, many, 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 many more of the people in North America, of the families in North America, enjoyed paid summer vacation. And so they, with the automobile and, you know, time off, more and more people could travel. And more, you know, people did. And so people traveling by car, the family traveling by car has become kind of the image of tourism on PEI, although we've been trying to diversify that for the last number of years. One transition in tourism, of course, I guess we could speak of several, but Many people at one time came here by train. The train gave way to the automobile. People traveling by ferry, and since 1997, by bridge. And increasingly, people come by air as well.
People can reach PEI through many means now, whether by crossing the bridge, taking the ferry, hopping on a cruise ship, or flying from all over the world. Consequently, the number and demographics of island visitors have witnessed noticeable changes, and I have Corinne, who will chat a little bit more about it.
Yeah, I think traditionally, you know, we would have seen a lot of Atlantic Canadians, and we still do. That is a very big and important market for us, is to drive traffic from our neighboring provinces. Over the years, we've seen a great extension of our visitation or travelers to Quebec and Ontario. We have really strong visitation from those provinces and also the Maine and the New England market. So, those would be our traditional markets from a visitation standpoint. But I think, too, when you look at the different segments of tourism, we have cruise, for example. It's interesting to see the mix of visitation from the different cruise lines. Some would bring in maybe a lot of Italians. Other lines would bring in a lot of individuals from Texas or California. So depending on how they're getting here, and I think there's opportunities, and we've done a really good job really casting that net wide.
As the pages of history turned, so too did the story of its attractions. Yet, many of PEI tourist attractions have stood the test of time, and the nature of their appeal remains unwavering. And with Anne of Green Gables, our island has even captivated hearts of folks beyond our borders, as far as Asia and Japan.
And so, while some attractions have emerged, we haven't really lost anything in terms of theming. So in the 1800s, people were coming here for the salt air and the beaches and the pastoral landscape. By the 1920s and 30s, we had added the idea that the people who lived in the landscape were a traditional culture, a kind of throwback that people could enjoy. But also, we'd become a pilgrimage site for lovers of the works of L.M. Montgomery, particularly Anne of Green Gables. And Anne of Green Gables, not only did the sites associated with those books become an attraction, the Prince Edward Island that was described in those books became itself an attraction. And those books had global reach. And ultimately, you had tourists coming here from as far away as Asia and Japan, for example, because they had fallen in love with the Prince Edward Island that was described in the Montgomery books. And that was a Prince Edward Island very similar to the tourism marketing island of the pastoral landscape with the pastoral people.
Yes, you'll find all things Anne on Prince Edward Island, but for the culture nerds, I also want to stress that our heritage extends far beyond just Anne. Wherever you stand on the island, you're standing on history. Whether you're interested in Mi'kmaq culture, trains, historic architecture, or museums and heritage sites bring the stories and the history of PEI to life. The Prince Edward Island Museum and Heritage Foundation, yes, that's us, operates 7 museum and heritage sites that provide islanders and visitors with an opportunity to discover our province's heritage and culture. I have Dr. Matthew McCrae, Executive Director of the Foundation, here today. Matthew, can you share with us some highlights of the museum and heritage sites you administer?
So history and heritage plays a really big role in tourism here in PEI. Visitors come to PEI because it's different, because it feels anti-modern to an extent. Here at the Museum and Heritage Foundation, that's kind of what we're in the business of doing. We're sharing the island's history. We've got 7 sites where we do that, and each site showcases a different aspect of the island's past that you can immerse yourselves in. For example, at Orwell Corner Historic Village, we have an entire village you can walk through and you can be transported back to 1895. We also have Elmira Railway Museum, so you can relive PEI's railway past. Our shipbuilding museum, where you can learn about what was the island's biggest industry at one time. And of course, we have our fisheries museum, and the fisheries have always been important on Prince Edward Island since time immemorial.
All of that sounds super exciting. I love that there are sites that you can visit year-round. And you just inspired me to get out of my house in the winter. I'll have to sign up for a workshop at EPTEC next time. Is there a must-visit or must-try activities you would recommend our listeners?
Absolutely. I think, again, going back to Orwell is a great example. We have a number of experiences you can do. You can have the bread and butter experience and make your own bread and butter. Go and feed the animals and see what it was like to operate a farm in the 1800s. We also have a ghost tour at Green Park in the summertime. And of course, in the fall, we have a lot of programming at various sites like Beaconsfield, where you can go and you can experience Victorian seance. And then there is also the Acadian Museum, all kinds of programming to learn about our French heritage and culture.
Matthew, all of that sounds amazing. And I also want to recommend the Beaconsfield Victorian Christmas experience that takes place every December at Beaconsfield Historic House in Charlottetown. I got the pleasure to attend it earlier last Christmas, and it was so magical to immerse in such a gorgeous space while learning about Christmas traditions, tuning into a harp concert, sipping on cider, and snacking on festive cookies. It was simply fantastic. So many fun things to do at the museum and heritage sites, and I'll suggest that folks check out their events and programming. They have all the information on the website peimuseum.ca and social media site with a handle heritagepei. Thank you for tuning in, Matthew. If you're currently in PEI, make sure to show our provincial museums some love. There are also various community museums across PEI. Each of them tells a unique story that shapes the identity of PEI heritage. There's no doubt that tourism has brought about positive changes to the island, but this is not to say that its rapid growth does not come without shortcomings. In fact, not all islanders were big fans of tourism at the beginning. Since the early development of tourism, islanders have expressed concern over the potential negative impact of this industry. Our executive director, Matthew McRae, has looked into this as part of his research about tourism and development on PEI from 1939 to 1973, and I have him right here to talk more about this sentiment with us.
So there's always been this underlying tension between tourism and its boosters and other islanders who feel far more ambivalent towards tourism. And I think this comes from the fact that tourism has been such a central feature of plans to modernize the island, to modernize its economy and allow us to keep up with all the other provinces, financially speaking. But tourism also requires that Prince Edward Island stay beautiful and look anti-modern. It has this, that has a quaint feel. And I think this tension between the fact that tourism requires this anti-modernism while promoting itself as a pathway to modernism and to prosperity has made it difficult. The second tension, of course, is quite frankly the inconveniences islanders experience. When I think of a great quote from the poet Milton Acorn, who called tourists sports in 1975, and he said, "That's the trouble with the island, sports. Those sports kept coming more and more. We didn't object because the island is a visible sample of heaven. This evidence of the truth of religion shouldn't be kept from anybody as long as they came in reasonable numbers." But then some sports started calling the tourist trade an industry. He complains that he thinks it's hard to find an islander in the crowd now. Now, that was in 1975, and in fact, in 1944, the premier of our province, Walter Jones, wrote, "There are already more tourists coming than we can accommodate." There's always been this sense of being a little bit overwhelmed, of it taking up too much space, and I think any islander who wants to find parking in downtown Charlottetown in the summer can commiserate with this feeling that of being overwhelmed by tourists. So how many tourists is too many tourists is always a question that's been asked by islanders that felt ambivalent. But on the other side of that was this other requirement from islanders that we all be nice and polite. Because of course, another thing about the island is that it's quaint. Everyone's so nice, everyone's so kind. But tourism constantly worked, the boosters of tourism constantly worked to make the island more nice. But at the same time, to run it like a business, to run it as a service, right? In the 1940s, Aubin Arsenault, who's a huge tourism booster and had been premier of Prince Edward Island, he said, "We have a regular gold mine here, but we're doing very little to extract the gold." And this kind of spoke to how a lot of boosters saw the tourism industry as a resource that you could mine for profits. But that really goes against the notion of natural kindness and hospitality. So there was this tension between how much can we do this before we sell our souls? And in the 1970s, that really came to a head. In 1973, we had 100th anniversary celebrations of PEI joining Confederation, and the government used this as an opportunity to try to draw tourists in. But it also caused a widespread resistance to the story that the province was telling about itself as this tourist province that had endless amounts of fun for visitors, and that was a place to that celebrated its past. Groups formed to oppose this narrative. There was the Brothers and Sisters of Cornelius Howitt, which is just a really unwieldy name, but they named it after one of the last members of the legislature to resist entering Confederation. And they did this because, of course, in 1873, the island had resisted Confederation. They hadn't been very interested and only joined reluctantly. And they wanted that side of the story to come out. And what they said, this is what they connected to, they said, we're in the process of being conditioned to think of ourselves not as an independent agricultural and fishing community, but as a pandering people, a province of flunkies and attendants. Our principal occupation, we are encouraged to believe, is to satisfy Prince Edward Island's centennial decade and the imagined needs and fancies of the tourists who are lured to the island by glossy promotional literature in the big sell, even though this involves an abandonment of our traditional values and lifestyle. So them's fighting words, I think we could all agree. Now, obviously, tourism is a key part of our economy. Obviously, many islanders benefit from tourism, but there was always this tension, I think, for islanders that still exists today of how do we be good hosts and profit from tourism and yet also retain our soul and our way of life at the same time. And I think that tension has really spoken over the decades to many, many islanders, whether it's dealing with the crowds, whether it's figuring out how to connect capitalism and your traditional way of life, or whether it's figuring out what the island wants to be and what story it wants to tell about who it is, not just to the world, but more importantly to itself. So I think all those things combined to create, well, attention in tourism, as I said at the start. And I think that islanders are still navigating that today, and probably as long as there are tourists coming to PEI, always will be navigating these questions. And I hope so, because they really get to the root of who we want to be and how we want to share ourselves with the world.
We've talked about how the heritage sites, coupled with the pristine beaches, delectable cuisines, and outdoor adventures are here to stay. But are you also curious to see what other potentials our little island can still tap into? Step by step, our island has embraced change, focusing on season extension, high-yield visitation, and cultural experiences. Indigenous tourism in particular has flourished, and they offer a profound understanding of the Mi'kmaq heritage.
You know, even nationally, we see a strong push on promoting and developing Indigenous tourism. I think it's part of Canada's history, and it's important to tell that story. And we've seen some great product development within our Indigenous Tourism Association here on PEI. They spent the last couple of years kind of working to build that association. Outside of that, you know, we have Lennox Island. They've done incredible work with some of the product that they're offering. And I think it's really important that we remember that it's telling a story. It's telling an important story. So we talk about it as tourism, and it is tourism, but it's also telling an important story within our Canadian history. So
Indigenous tourism initiatives can contribute to the economic growth and empowerment of local Indigenous communities while promoting cross-cultural understanding and collaboration. Make sure to visit the Lennox Island to immerse in the Indigenous culture this summer. You can sign up for workshops to learn how to make quills, weave drums, and bake bannocks from scratch. And you'll leave with a full heart and a deeper understanding of the beautifully rich culture, the history, and the traditions of the Mi'kmaq on PEI. Meanwhile, ecotourism, a celebration of our natural beauty, has come to the forefront, and it has been showcasing the island's commitment to sustainable adventure.
In terms of the ecotourism, this is something too that I think we are well suited to really grow and expand on. And we have some great operators here doing some phenomenal things with ecotourism. We have a beautiful trail system that we can access and utilize. So these are really two very important drivers, I think, in moving forward from a strategic standpoint on developing and really promoting that product to visitors.
I'm so excited to hear so many different perspectives, and I think it's such an exciting time for tourism and PEI to bloom. And we've heard incredible sharings from the perspectives of historians and industry professionals, but what is tourism and PEI really like in the eyes of tourists? We invited Monisha Rodericks, a visitor from India who recently came to visit the island. Hi, Monisha.
Hello, everyone. My name is Monisha Rodericks, and I'm here from India. This is my first time in Canada, and especially in this beautiful island of Prince Edward Island, also known as PEI.
Welcome to PEI. I hope you've had an incredible time. Where did you go during your trip? Where is your favorite place to visit?
On the island, there are some beautiful places to visit. On my trip here a month ago, I had the privilege to go right up to the north of Rustico to look at the beautiful beach of Cavendish, and then also to visit the lovely lighthouses. The various places that I visited on my trip here, and I was amazed, was Victoria-by-the-Sea, Beaconsfield, the Victoria Park, the waterfront, and each one is amazing and beautiful to just sit and look at. My favorite place to visit here in the island would be the library, the Charlottetown Public Library. It was a place which is quiet, serene, and still a lot to do. I learned a lot on my visit.
Sounds like you really had a good taste of what PEI has to offer. Could you share some interesting stories of your trip with us?
Something that attracts me about PEI is, firstly, question would be asked, what is it that you find in PEI that is the smallest province in Canada? I grew up with a saying, or a thought, I would say, even one of the smallest piece, if we don't put it into a puzzle, keeps the puzzle incomplete. And that's what PEI does. It is that one little small and important piece that makes Canada so beautiful. The main attraction of PEI, for me, it was an attraction and it also intrigued me, was the culture and the people. The culture of having family time, the culture of going on picnics, getting along with nature, working in the mud, the beautiful churches here, the people, the islanders, the ones I have met have been really kind. They wait for you. They are helpful.
Thank you, Monisha. I'm so glad you've enjoyed your visit to the island. Monisha reminds us that PEI is not just a destination, but it's a puzzle piece that completes Canada's beauty. And that's so poetic. As we are close to the end, I wonder, is there anything else that really transformed PEI from a quiet escape to a global magnet for travelers? Well, let's not forget that we are blessed to be on an island, and islandness in and of itself is already a captivating allure.
Islandness is an attraction. People are fascinated by islands. They are different. They have a sense of otherness, and there's no place but on an island that has a greater sense of here and there. The boundedness of an island sets it apart.
To all of those listening, tourism and PEI might mean different things to you. If you're from out of province and want to pay a visit, brace yourself because you're in for a treat. There's something fun and fulfilling for everyone on the island, regardless of their walks of life. And if you're an islander, whether by birth or by choice like me, enjoy and appreciate all the island has to offer. Let us preserve the enduring charm of this gentle island and make sure that it's a place that continues to captivate the hearts of travelers like Monisha and all of us who seek solace and adventure. In the spirit of reconciliation, I want to acknowledge that the land upon which this podcast is produced is unceded Mi'kmaq territory. Epiwit, Mi'kma'ki, is covered by the historic treaties of peace and friendship. We pay our respects to the indigenous Mi'kmaq people who have occupied this island for over 12,000 years, past, present, and future. The Hidden Island podcast is proudly sponsored by the Confederation Center of the Arts, the Provincial Credit Union, and the Grey Group. We'd also like to extend our sincere thanks to Food Island PEI, Waterprint Corner Shop, and Upstreet Craft Brewing Company for the support. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode of The Hidden Island.